Hello and welcome to episode 129 of Just Get a Real Job. I'm of course your host, Jamie McKinley, and thank you as always for tuning in. Thank you for listening. It occurred to me when recording this week's episode that it'll be coming up for 4 years in November this year since we launched this podcast, and just the idea that it's been 4 years since 2020, it's just a bit mental. So I've just been thinking about that a lot the last couple of days as I sit down to record these intros. It's quite unusual because I normally record episodes quite far in advance, but this week's episode was literally recorded last night, so it's really fresh in my mind. And joining us on the podcast this week is the talented actor and writer Sarah Cameron West. It was very, very nice to chat to Sarah last night. She is about to put on her one-woman show, Karen, at the Other Palace Theatre in London on the 19th of March. So we spoke all about that. It's very exciting. And this is on the back of Sarah's successful run with Karen at the Edinburgh Fringe last year as well. Sarah has a number of other credits as well. She is going to be in an Amazon Prime show called Anansi Boys, which is scheduled for release later in the year, I believe. It's not got an official date yet, but that's been in post for a while, so it should be due out soon. Yeah, we really, really enjoyable conversation with Sarah. We actually chatted a little bit about how to send emails to, for example, people like agents or people professionally in the creative industries, which we haven't had an in-depth conversation about on this podcast before, so it's quite interesting. Me and Sarah sort of talked about do's and don'ts and things we've learned from our experiences in regards to sending emails. And I suppose the core message, which is obviously the name of this episode, we spoke a lot about how you can create your own opportunities and some of the ways you can think outside the box to do that. And Sarah had some really interesting examples from her career and how she's done that over the years, which will particularly be interesting to people and useful to people as well, especially if you're an aspiring actor. But I think it applies to any sort of creative roles in this industry. So that was really, really interesting. I enjoyed starting the week by chatting to Sarah on a Monday night. It was a really nice way to do that. So I hope you guys enjoy this episode. Just wanted to quickly say as well, thank you to everyone that's listened to last week's conversation with acclaimed puppeteer Dave Chapman. Be sure and check that one out if you haven't yet. Dave has been working in the industry for a long, long time as a puppeteer, and his credits include everything from CBBC's Otis the Aardvark in the 1990s to BB-8 in Star Wars The Force Awakens. So he's had a pretty cool career, and it's an amazing conversation if you get the chance to go and check that one out. That came out last week. Of course, this is episode 129, so yeah, there's lots of great episodes in our back catalogue. So if this is your first time listening and you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to go back and check out some of our older ones. But without much further ado, I hope you enjoy episode 129 with the wonderful Sarah Cameron West. Creative industries are merely mess. Artists lie their goods are torn to shreds. The government will spoil your hopes and dreams by offering a useless retraining scheme. With such amazing talent, why can't you see that the government has decimated the industry? And now the years of hard work could be thrown away. And people who don't care will they say, just get a real job. Sarah, lovely to meet you. Thank you very much for coming on Just Get a Real Job on a Monday night at 7 o'clock. It's greatly appreciated.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, it's always nice to do this, especially the start of the week, actually, because you sort of run up to it, you're like, oh, I'm quite tired, like, is this the right time? And then you do it, you're like, nah, this is like a great way to just kick the week off. And
100% energizes you on your Monday. Yeah. Start of the week always feels overwhelming, so it's nice to have something really exciting. Yeah. And I think I definitely really felt that this week because everything's kicking off for Karen in the next sort of 2 weeks. So it's nice to feel like I'm doing something towards that.
Yeah, and for everyone listening that maybe isn't aware of what Karen is, that you're doing a one-woman show, which is on the 19th of March, isn't it? It's only a few weeks away.
Yeah, exactly. It's one-woman character comedy show called Karen, and it's on at the Other Palace from the 19th to the 24th of March. It's amazing. The first like proper London transfer down from the Edinburgh Fringe where it was last year. So yeah, I'm super, super excited.
That's very exciting. And we've got lots to talk about from your career, and obviously we'll get into the show in a bit more depth as well. But just to start everything off, do you want to just sort of introduce yourself to our listeners? Tell us a bit, just the broad strokes, but just give us a bit of an idea of what you do and who you are, etc.
Sure. The broad strokes of Sarah Cameron West, sure. Well, actually, my real name is Sarah Cameron, but that was taken on Spotlight, so I had to be Sarah Cameron West. So that's the fun fact. And because a lot of actors seem to double barrel their names, I didn't want to change my first name. name because I wanted to keep that. And then I didn't really want to change my last name either. So I thought I'll just stick one on. So I went to Durham University and I studied liberal arts there. So history and history of art. And I was really lucky and went there on a drama scholarship. And then I went to the Drama Centre, which is a drama school in London, to do my master's in acting, where I trained there. And then COVID-19 hit when I was there, so didn't graduate the best time, but it was a terrible time for so many people. And then I've just been working in the industry for the last, gosh, what is it, 4-5 years?
Where's the last 4 or 5 years?
Where has it gone? Insane, where has it gone? It's frightening. I'm getting so much older and I hate it.
Yeah, everyone said that since COVID, though. They're just like, this has just been crazy. Like the last, I think every guest I've spoke to has just all said the same thing. Like the last, where have the last 4 years went?
It's where have they gone?
Wild.
Someone asked me my age the other day and I honestly said 23 because I really believed it. I am 27. That is horrific.
Same age as me. I'm also 27. And it's just, and it's, I know.
27 clubs crazy. Where it's at. No, so that yeah. I would say is kind of broadly what I do. But then since then, I set up my own company called Any Second Now with my business partner, Lucy Nicholson, who I met at Durham. And we wrote our own TV series, sitcom together called Jack and Jill, which we're currently trying to get into development. We've also written a couple of other scripts, but our main thing we did, we set up some shows across London called It Takes Two, just to give writers, actors, directors a place to come together, trial out new work, a bit like a scratch night. I just felt that sometimes, especially straight after the pandemic, being a creative in London can feel quite isolating unless you're in a cast or in a show. So I really wanted to just bring people together, make some young connections of other people in the industry. And we had so much fun doing it. We did it at the Hen and Chickens, the Golden Goose, the King's Head. That was kind of what we started. And it gave me a real passion for my own writing, which then led to Karen, my one-woman show.
Well, that was a very succinct broad strokes answer, to be fair. And, you know, we'll get into sort of all, we'll go through that all sort of in a bit more detail. But just to cast your mind far back, 27 years, of course, you know, saying you're in like, but do you remember like your earliest creative memories? Like, were you always quite into the arts growing up and things?
Ooh. Yeah, I definitely think my parents would agree. I think they would say from a very young age, if I was in nursery, by the end of the day, a play would be made with all the other children. I would be the star and director of. I don't think you've met a more confident flower in the Billy Goat's Gruff or tree in various other productions. I think my most formative, earliest creative memory, though, was I did a talent show at my school when I was, gosh, I must have been maybe 9 or 10. And it was, I did a Harry Potter sketch. it was when that fabulous video came out. Oh God, I'm going to embarrass myself singing it, but you know, I'm Harry Potter. Harry Potter.
I think that, you know, yeah.
It was, I
remember that.
That was the
rave, like 2008.
Exactly.
2008, 2007. Yeah. Well, I might find. I'll try and find that and link it right here.
Do because otherwise,
because people will listen and they'll be like, I do remember it. Yeah.
Harry Potter. Peak 10-year-old humor. So I made a little sketch based on that with my friends. And it was for this huge talent show across like the all of the years that go up until I think it was 18. And this little 10-year-old me pitching up on a stage.
Quite brave, to be fair.
It was all delusional. And, you know, I had like parents come, governors come, like all these like various people come. And yeah, it's literally started with me in a spotlight in a Voldemort costume. Pretty bold way to start, but I remember it was only like a 5-minute, 10-minute sketch maybe, and I just remember coming off the stage and feeling this complete electricity and excitement and joy, and people had really seemed to enjoy it. It was like for the next few weeks after at school, people were like, oh, I loved your sketch. And my parents, hilarious, didn't really know that I was, they knew I liked drama, but didn't know how serious I was about it. So they didn't make it in time for the show.
Oh, no.
So they had to watch it in a classroom where they recorded it outside. They were like live streaming it, which is crazy because back in whatever it was in the noughties, they were live streaming it onto that. So they watched it and their like friends came out and were going, did you see your daughter? She was so funny. So that was probably my earliest memory.
That's quite a successful early memory to have. A lot of the time people are quite either not embarrassed, but they're like, oh yeah, I did this thing and it was probably terrible, but I loved it at the time.
Or, to be fair, you know, it's so funny. Once you start talking about it, jogs another one. Actually, an earlier one I have, I was in year 3 and it was my big moment. I'd just been cast as Little Red Riding Hood in the like fairy tale little play that each class did. And I was absolutely in my element, knew all my lines. I was so excited. And then we were driving into school that day and I vomited outside the car. And I was so unwell. I had like a tummy bug and sobbing to my mum. I was like, I've got to go into school. It's my part. And she's like, darling, you're really not well. I'm going to take you home. If you're better, maybe you can come back to school. And I remember coming back in and we were on the phone to my teacher before I came in and she was like, do you really think you can do this, Sarah? And I was like, yeah, no, I absolutely can. I feel really good. I'm going to be fine. Anyway, and we're in the like school gym and on the stage and a class before has just gone and we're all sitting there and the like gym is so hot. You can see me at the front of the stage. And I just start swaying. And my dad is at the back and he's like, oh no. He looks at me and gives me a thumbs up. And I go, uh-uh. I shake my head and go, no. And my dad runs to the front of the stage, picks me up, and we run outside and then I vomit in the playground. And that was awful. So probably unsuccessful there. Had to pull it together again when I got older. But that's probably my earliest. And I think, yeah, it sort of damaged my reputation at school because they thought, oh, she's got terrible stage fright. And I was like, so it's fine. I had to like build back up my
Was this before Harry Potter or after Harry Potter?
This was before pre-Harry
Potter. So that Harry Potter sketch won back your reputation.
Totally. I think, and that was year 3 when I viewed year 4. They were like, we're not going to give her the main part. We're going to give her, it was Robin Hood. We're going to give her Maid Marian's, one of her little ladies. And I fought back for my position. And then I think I got Mrs. Noah in Noah and the Ark in year 5. And I was like, we're back, baby. And then year 6, smashed it.
I mean, it's an impressive memory as well, to be fair. You got a lot of detail in there, which is good. I mean, a lot of time people are like, I think I used to draw. And interesting. Then sort of other part of this question, which I always find really interesting to ask, is about how where you're from has influenced you as a creative person. So I actually don't know where you're from because that was something I couldn't find out. So where are you from and how has that influenced?
It's a good question. I feel it's a funny one because I feel, I should say, I'm from Chichester. That's where I spent that's where I spent the longest time. But I grew up in quite a few different places. So it's hard to be like, I'm just from one place. I lived in Dorking, then lived in London, then moved to Oxford, then moved down to West Sussex, Chichester. So basically kind of generally south.
It's all south to me anyway.
It's all south. It's like, there's not... Actually, everyone in the South will be like, it's not the same, but definitely there's not sort of a major, I feel, defining difference, perhaps, in terms of how it's affected me creatively. But growing up in Chichester was a really, I think more in terms of rather than geographically, but in terms of the support network I had there, really pulled me into my own. I hadn't necessarily had the happiest time, like always moving school was difficult. You have to make new friends again and all of this. So finally settling somewhere that I was really happy in about year 7 was wonderful. And then I had the most amazing drama teacher called Mr. Cousins, who I absolutely adore. He's actually coming to see Karen in a couple of weeks. I'm so excited. And he was such a young, fun, inspiring teacher. Mm. And he really brought me out of my shell. I always loved drama, but I never thought I could take it anywhere, maybe. I don't know. And he kind of gave me the confidence to go, no, you could really do this for like your life if you wanted, if you wanted to do it as a career. And I was like, just do this thing that I love all the time.
Yeah, of course.
So I think, yeah, growing up in Chichester, it also gave me a lot of other hobbies as well. My dad's a really keen sailor, as is my brother. Growing up near the beach was always so gorgeous. And I love being there with my family. So I had a really strong support network at home in Chichester, which meant that always, my dad always says, it's like you can go out into the world, and then if it gets like overwhelming or you need your team, you come back, drop the drawbridge at home in Chichester, and you know, talk to your advisors. it was always nice.
It always makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think
to have
so.
A support network around you, whether that be people doing the same thing or family or friends, or yeah, it's I think it's key.
So I'd say rather than geographically, it just the people there really grounded me and gave me such a happy home and time there.
Where is Chichester on a map?
It's in between Brighton and Portsmouth.
Okay. I vaguely have an idea, yeah.
Yeah, and I have an honorary grandpa called Harry from Portsmouth, who I adore. So yeah, he's great, and he's very like Portsmouth. I love him. So he tells me all about the kind of what it's like to be from there. So I enjoy that.
So there's a bit of Portsmouth identity there as well.
Yeah, we can add that into the mix. Why not?
Before we sort of go on to talk about like your career and the sort of path you've taken and how it's got led to Karen and stuff, do you have a favorite word or phrase from like moving around and growing up where you have?
That's such a good question. Not especially one that comes to mind that's really clear. For me though, it's split in two. My family love like classic British idioms, you know, like little phrases like know your onions, ups and downs, what goes up must come down, one bird in the hand's worth two in the bush, all of those little like classic phrases I love, my family say quite a lot. So that's probably something, but not I suppose a typical word. The other thing though is my mum and I always do accents with each other, so it's more probably an accent thing rather than like we always just slip into like an American bit. It sort of started ironically, and now we can't stop.
You're always a sort of you always seem to be a comic performer, like deep down. You know what I mean? You've got, you're ready to slip
really
into it.
Funny, I never thought I was. I only did really serious stuff until like probably drama school. It just felt I was like, I'm a very serious actor. But I think the comedy's always been dying to come out, and I think that's kind of the special thing that I love. I think when you hit something, you're like, oh no, this is it. This is I'm in my element. That's really fun. But a specific word, no, do you?
Yeah, loads. But I mean, I feel like being Scottish is it's maybe easier because when I speak to a lot of English creative people, I mean, it depends what part, because England's such a big country as well. Like, so if you speak to people that are maybe from somewhere up north, like Yorkshire or something, they tend to have a strong identity. Whereas I tend to speak from people, or if you even people from London have a strong identity. Mm-hmm. Whereas I speak to people that are from sort of places that, not to generalize, obviously people are different, but often I tend to speak to people that are from maybe this like south of England tend to not have a strong an identity or a sense of place.
I think so. Like if I'd grown up in Oxford the whole time, I might have something. But because I kind of moved around, I don't suppose I feel particularly grounded in any one area. But yeah, I mean, my brother's up at Edinburgh University and he's picking up all the fabulous phrases. And so many good ones.
Although most people in Edinburgh are English, to be fair. You probably know that from the Fringe anyway.
But he loves it there. And I remember picking up a few when I was in Durham that I loved. And I think it just that gorgeous love of accents and different people and where they grow up. I love hearing about it. I think it was what makes us so gorgeous and different.
Yeah. No, I'm fascinated by English identity because it's such a weird thing that seems to... And I think that's why you have like things like Brexit and parties like UKIP and that sort of right-wing identity come from that sort of lack of self-identity in a way. Just an interesting thing, which I'm taking as a tangent. But going back to sort of your career, I suppose a question to start with is, do you remember the moment you thought, quite like to do this and make this into a serious career?
I think the thing with acting is I think you've got to have that conversation with yourself quite often. I think the first time I thought about it was when I was maybe 13, but not really. I think I sort of thought I could be a million things. I was like, well, obviously I'll be a Hollywood actor and I'll also be like a human rights lawyer for the UN. And obviously I'll also do all of these other things. And, you know, you think you can do it all and you should think that. But I think I really properly, seriously went, this is what I'm going to do when I was about 15. But still super sheltered. I mean, it wasn't really like I was doing anything with it. I was school. So just participating in school plays and the odd competition here and there. Did all my like Lambda grades. But I think as a creative, you've got to keep having that conversation. And people always talk about it. It's like whoever's holding on the longest. Is like, that's a big battle of it. So I remember having it again at 18, again at 21, being like, because you've got to keep jumping through so many hoops. It's like, okay, you get a drama scholarship to school, you go to university, or you go to drama school, or, and you don't need to do all of that. But I think for me, I very much wanted a plan, like, which is crazy that this is the career I've picked because it's so unstable. My friends find that really funny because I love to plan things to an nth degree, and this is just something you can't do that with.
And it's quite frustrating, isn't it? Because I'm the sort of person that I quite like security, like
totally
to an extent, like because I'm quite like, in all honesty, I'm probably quite an anxious person, so I don't like the idea that I can't really plan more than a year ahead for contracts of work, and that's what's very difficult in this industry when you're, and you know, you can still be a very creative person, but the uncertainty does make that quite a hard thing to deal with.
Totally. It really, really does. And I think I wanted to sort of, for me, what seemed like the clearest plan at the time was I'll go to drama school, I'll get an agent, and then I'll be in Hollywood, basically. And I think that is, everyone goes in when you're that age and you get into a drama school, and especially one of the like the top like five, all of them are brilliant. But when you get into a big one, you really think, oh, yeah, I've done it now. And there's so many more hoops to jump through. And I think even when you get your first big role, then there's more hoops and more and more. And the journey never stops. So, yeah, I think for me, it felt like that was the best way I could plan what I wanted to do. But I have to keep having the conversation regularly, checking in on myself, being like, you still want to do this? Because it's not that fun getting rejection emails. Yeah. And it's not that fun getting no's. And God, it's expensive to do anything.
Did you struggle with imposter syndrome at the start? Like, did you have that when you were at drama school? And for example, were you like, oh, Jesus, this is quite intimidating. Actually, there's quite a lot of talented people around.
Funnily enough, it was. Yeah, I mean, definitely you go in there being like, wow, these people are hot shots. But funnily enough, I feel more imposter syndrome now than I did back then, because I think we were all of a similar age. I was definitely one of the more experienced people there. You know, I'd done something like 25 plays in the last 3 years before going to drama school at university. I like rinsed the drama society at Durham. I wanted to be in everything, like
that's cool.
Do everything I could. And I'd done, got a drama scholarship to school. I got a drama scholarship to uni. So I was like feeling very confident on the stage is the like caveat for that. So, and I'd done like all my Lambda grades, all the Trinity grades, like everything you could probably do at 18, I'd done. And so going into Drama Center, I thought, yeah, I'm feeling pretty confident. And it really put it in sharp relief because I thought, I feel I've done everything I can on my own. And now I need help and tutorage to be brought to the next level, whatever that looks like. So everyone there was super talented and it pushed me so hard. But I loved it. There were definitely days like in my first term, I came away going, oh my God, I'm awful. But the thing is, the hardest battle is you've got to pick yourself up and go again. And I think what differentiates you a lot of the time is being able to take that criticism. And I definitely went to a drama school where people don't hold back. And I think that was definitely a good thing for me, because now it doesn't faze me at all. It just means I'm like, okay, cool, roll with it, because it's all about making you better. Obviously not be abusive and rude, but it was really constructive. And I think when acting comes from you,
Yeah.
It's hard not to take it personally. If, like, for example, your violin's out of tune, your violin's out of tune. It's not, wow, that's me playing badly. But with acting, it's like, oh, I didn't hit that note quite right. That was a bit flat. Or you need to be connected, but you also need to be able to see it, that it's a craft that you need to hone. Mm. And it's not just, I hope the gods of acting imbue me with brilliance today to do a good job. It's, you've got to really work at it. So I felt really confident at that time. Funnily enough, I felt really not confident coming out into the industry. It was so lonely. And I think especially in a time where people didn't want to sign you, we didn't get a showcase, we didn't get any of these things, felt really discombobulating.
It was the best word for the entire period of time. So discombobulating.
So discombobulating. Mm. And just finding your feet to go, okay, but classic, you know, probably very similar. I was like, right, what can I control? I can control writing. I'll start writing. Mm. And that is what got me into writing, because I thought, well, I can make my own little sketches. I can make my own little movies on iMovie. And, you know, I can start doing this. And it just gave me something that I could rely on myself rather than waiting for the phone to ring all the time. That was probably the biggest one for me.
And do you think that's what drove you to sort of do those scratch nights as well, which seems 100%. Like it played a massive part in sort of allowing you back into that community, which is, again, at the time, so important. Like, you know, this podcast started in lockdown for a reason as well. Like, it was a very common thing. And what's interesting about having started this nearly, which, oh my God, 4 years this year, which is,
that's actually quite mad.
It's quite mad. But like, thinking about the interviews going back from then till now, like, there's clearly, like, it's interesting how people were dealing with that at the time. And because I remember chatting to so many people that were like, I'm feeling really discombobulated and like, I don't have a community, etc. And it's interesting that now when you have people on this that look back and go, oh, it was so key that I did this thing, or, you know, it's just a really interesting reflection. Yeah,
I think, and like the fact that people were doing Zoom readings and Zoom plays, and it just feels so mad that we were doing that, and like how theatre was shut down. And I think, yeah, the biggest thing for me then was like the reliance now on self-tapes. And I never felt particularly confident in front of the camera necessarily. So learning how to get comfortable with that was a big learning curve, I think. But everyone always says once you come out of drama school, you learn the most like on your first few jobs, and you keep learning. But yeah, I definitely started writing and doing my own thing so that I could feel like I was a bit more in control of my own life. And I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to think of practical things. So there'll be lots of people listening that can relate to your journey and or have similar things, particularly maybe who want to be actors or are actors. But how did you sort of go about getting an agent at that point then? Was that a hard thing? Did that just sort of come through chance and hard work? Or
I'd love to say that they just saw me and they picked me and it was easy. It was like 6 months after graduating of just cold emailing. Any email I could get my hand on, like,
wow,
just email my showreel, my this, invite them to shows. And then literally just one day, my agent, who did eventually tell me, I sent him an email. He replied in 10 minutes, which after 6 months was unheard of. And he replied and was like, yeah, let's have a phone call. Love your work. Had a phone call and he was like, love to offer you representation. I was like, that's unbelievable. Amazing. And I've been signed with him since 2021. So I think that's the thing. It's just, there's no rhyme or reason. And a lot of friends I've had, it was either, for most, it's you get signed off your showcases from drama school. I didn't have that. So that was a shame. And that was a shame for pretty much all of the drama schools across my year group. So a lot of us just cold emailed. A lot of us had friends who had been signed who we could get in front of, or just started getting cast in things as best we could and inviting agents and people to come and see it. But it took us all quite a long time, I felt, from like my group to kind of break the back of it, because also agents didn't want to sign people at that time because they were like, I can't even get my current clients work because there's so little of it, so I'm not gonna bring on more people. But I think it's a lot better now. But my biggest advice would be get IMDb Pro. and look at all the actors you like, see who their agents are and start emailing them. And then I would say start putting, if you can, get in a play or put on your own play wherever you can, or film a little something, just so that the thing with getting people to come and see your work is great, because if you keep inviting them, hopefully just a process of attrition, people will come. But it does take time, and I can't say I found it particularly easy at all. But I hope that just if you keep putting your heart in the game and you keep producing work, something's got to give.
And if you send a certain amount of emails, it's like, just statistically, like, obviously it's not guaranteed, but usually one, at least one in 100 will probably get back to you. But of course, there's also the other thing, there's ways of emailing people, because I'm very happy to, you know, speak to people that are wanting to break into the script editing and TV and things, and I get quite a lot of emails. But I find it really interesting, because I always try to respond, but sometimes you do get emails and you think, why written this email like that? When people email and they put the wrong name on because they copied and pasted it, that's always quite a bad look.
That's rough.
When people just ask, like, just say, hey, like, how do I do this? And don't, you know what I mean? It's just like, there's thinking about how
effort and time into it. Like anything. Oh, this is actually my word. Slapdash. That's my dad's word. Anything slapdash is never gonna get you. Well, it does sometimes, but don't do it.
Yeah.
But of like, if putting in effort is always better than not putting in effort. And I think for me, it's, you know, really look at, you are sending so many of the same email again. I appreciate like sometimes bits are the same, but
get
people's names right. Be polite. Say, how are you? Introduce yourself. I'm emailing you because I'm interested in this. This is a little bit about me. If you'd be interested in having a chat, or have any advice for a young grad or anything like that, it's a much nicer, people are more likely to respond, especially if you're not directly grabbing for something. I had an agent workshop the other day, and she was like, don't just be like, can I have representation with you, please?
No, exactly. 100. I think that's a very good way of saying it, actually, because often a nice one as well can sometimes be, hey, like, I know you do this for a living. Would you be happy to get a coffee sometime if you have time?
100%.
That's like something like that. It's really nice, because there's no expectation on that. It's just
a coffee. And the agent said the same thing. They were just like, just say, oh, and if any of this is of interest, I'd love to have a coffee with you to think if there's a future for me at X place. And how nice that is. It takes the pressure off them. It means that you get in front of them without having to say an answer. And it's such a balance, because you've also got to get out there. You've also got to ask for what you want. But you got to be polite about it. And these people, they're busy, and a lot of them it's a savage, very competitive world. If you don't tick all those boxes, say, oh, I'm just going to press delete, straight into trash. And I appreciate that's harsh, but I wish when I look back at some of the emails I sent straight out of drama school, I think, oh, bless her.
It's a learning experience. And when I said earlier that I have had some emails where I'm like, oh, that doesn't come across well, I do understand that people don't mean any malicious by that. They do mean well. And I don't, when I say that, I'm not trying to, I think it's more just that it's a thing for people to learn and just think about. I think it's a useful tip and a useful bit of advice.
100%. Also be pleasantly surprised, which I really love as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I put on, and this is the other thing I would say to people, is like, don't feel you need to have the final product or you have to be in a really grand theater just to get stuff put on and made. Just get it in a pub theater if you can. I did my first proper play outside of drama school in my friend's grandma's front room for an audience of 10 people, and obviously unpaid, and didn't charge them for tickets. Our whole tech was her little sister turning the lights up and down. And I had the balls to invite serious casting directors to that.
But I think that's brilliant, though. That's great.
It's a story. And bless, I emailed these casting directors now who I have a relationship with, and they go, I thought that was so sweet. It's so naive, but it's so sweet. And obviously they didn't come, But like, but it meant that you're on their radar and they're like, okay, she's hungry. She wants to do this. She's putting on her own thing. And that shows so much to people.
People love initiative and enthusiasm as well.
People love initiative and they want to work with people like that from my experience. And I think the other thing, people love to work with reliable people. So I think when you do get that lucky shot, don't squander it. Be polite. Make sure you're engaging with people there. And, you know, you say thank you at the end of the day for people looking after you, because they'll remember you fondly and they'll want you back. And like a lot of this industry is connection. And if you were good on a job, it takes one word from that casting director to go, who is that? I love them. I want to bring them back on that. Or even a runner going, oh, they were lovely.
And it just counts for so much.
And
the amount of times that you meet somebody once and 2 years later, they come around and you meet them again and they could play a part in getting you a job or leading 100%. To an opportunity. It's like, never be a dick to anyone. That's like the
big... Never. Always be polite is the biggest
thing. It comes up so often on the podcast because it's so true. And I'm sure some of the listeners be like, you'd said that so much to me, but it's just true. Like, just try and never, ever be a dick.
Be rude. I mean, it's not worth it, because I've definitely had it where someone's worked with someone and they've had a terrible time and they've said to me, under no circumstances should you work with that person. And like, that's crazy. It stops you getting jobs, which in an industry that's already super competitive, you want to just mitigate for any of that. Like, just be nice. It's not hard.
But let's speak about Karen, because I'm aware, and that was a really interesting sort of bit of advice about emails and stuff, which I don't think we'd went into a lot of detail in the podcast about before. So I really enjoyed that little segment as well. But tell us about Karen, which I know some of the press have been comparing to things like Peep Show and Fleabag. But do you find that annoying, actually, when people like compare it to things? Because sometimes that might not be an influence on your work. I mean, they're both great shows, so I'm sure it's a compliment, but...
It's totally a compliment, but I know what you mean. But it's actually could be a double-edged sword, because it's obviously so overwhelmingly flattering, but it does mean that people then come with an expectation that it's going to be as amazing as that. And that obviously makes me feel so nervous.
Yeah.
But people, for example, I think any one woman show that's funny about a woman in her like late 20s, early 30s experiencing life is gonna probably be compared to Fleabag. So I think there's kind of a running joke when I did the Soho Theatre Labs, there were a lot of solo shows, a lot of one woman shows. And it was almost like when we were going around explaining what our show was about, and sure, some are like completely different and so amazing, but the word that no one wanted to say was, it's kind of like Fleabag, which I thought was so funny. But Phoebe Waller-Bridge is my total icon. She's my icon. She's my world. I want to be just like her. I think her writing is so incredible, visceral, poignant, beautiful. I think her acting is sensational. She produces as well. There's nothing she can't do.
I know, it's kind of hard though when you look at her and you go, oh my God, like, it's just so talented.
She's everything I aspire to be. Same with Sharon Horgan, same with Michaela Cole. They're just my idols. And so to be compared in any capacity to that is incredibly
flattering. Well, it's a massive compliment. Yeah, it's interesting as well, because when I first started working in TV, like Fleabag, the whole thing was the question every interview I got asked when I would go for jobs would be like, what's the current trends in TV? And at the time it was like everyone wants to make the new Fleabag, but I feel like 3 years later it's almost the opposite, where people were like, that's been overdone. So
totally,
as you say, it's seen as a negative, as you're saying, like people are avoiding trying to say it. Not a negative,
I
it's the wrong
so.
word.
I think people, you're always trying to reinvent the wheel, aren't you? And I think we're human beings. There's so many similar stories across the thing, and it shouldn't be tarnished just because it's too similar. Like, if it's similar, it's probably going to be good. You're probably going to like it. And I think for me, that's why I didn't feel afraid when doing Karen to talk about a really universal experience, which is getting your heart broken. I am not the first play to talk about heartbreak, and I'm certainly not the last. I may be the only play that starts the show with our protagonist getting dumped on her 30th birthday at Alton Towers midway through a calippo. That might be unique. And sort of the ingredients that make Karen a fun show is she gets dumped by her long-term boyfriend Joe on her birthday. horrific. Can I make it any worse? Yes, I can. Jo has been having an affair with her arch nemesis, Karen, hence the name of the show. And then the cherry on top is they all work in the same office. Ugh. So now we've got like passion, pain, office pandemonium. She's dealing with heartbreak, but trying to remain professional. And it's like that tug of war, which ultimately unleashes in this huge office finale explosion. That's kind of what Karen is about in a nutshell. And I think the main message of it is it discusses how tackling your feelings head on is so important rather than pushing them down and letting them build, because then they'll probably manifest themselves in different very toxic ways. For example, our protagonist, she can't process her emotions in a healthy way. All she can do is go to her car, lock the door and blast Slipknot and scream. That's like her coping mechanism. And that's just not sustainable. So it is very much a comedy show, but I think it's got a deeper message of like how to look after yourself and process your own mental health. And the path to healing sometimes lies in tackling something head on and going through it and letting it wash over you than trying, if you keep trying to avoid it. But everybody's journey is different. And I think a lot of discussion about like female rage and what that means and why does it have to be gendered. That's all been a really interesting sort of political stance in it. And I feel very grateful to my wonderful director, Evie-Ez Townsend, who's held my hand and shaped Karen into something so much more than what I thought it could be of just a funny little sketch. She's made it so three-dimensional and fabulous. So I'm very, very grateful. So yeah, it's a funny comedy show about heartbreak if you want to catch it from the 19th to the 24th of March in the Other Palace.
And are you taking it anywhere after this as well? You'd like to take it back to Edinburgh again, for example?
I'm thrilled to say that I'm taking it back up to Edinburgh. I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival this 2024 and I'm overjoyed to be part of the Underbelly season for the whole of August, which is going to be mad. And I'm going to be at the Deli Belly at 3:55 p.m. for the whole of August.
You'd already got that date and time in there. My God, that's impressive.
The Fringe waits for no man. Honestly, I was in September after the last Fringe, I was already emailing and they were like, they open in, a lot of people start giving their offers in November of the previous year. But last year for Karen, because I took Karen up to the Fringe 2023 and I took it up really last minute. I think I applied in April, which was crazy.
That's normally when I stick the application in for the podcast, but it's just terrible. I'm going to do it again this year, but it's fine.
Oh my God, no.
I did do it like, it's always last minute like, though. It's
whatever
always like...
happens, but yeah. The stress is insane.
I know. But easier for that.
Yeah. I had no expectation. I just thought, oh, because I wrote Karen as a 10-minute sketch that I submitted to a monologue competition called Project Passion by Velvet Smoke in 2021. Mm. And I got selected as one of the finalists. So it got to be performed at the White Bear in Kennington. Really pleased with the reception and was encouraged then to turn it into a one-woman show. And then it kind of sat on the back burner. And then in 2023, I just thought, I'm just going to write this. And maybe I'll go to the Fringe. I've always wanted to go. I'll just see. So I sent an email in April. And I didn't try for like a big one like Underbelly or Assembly or Pleasance because there's no way that you get that that late on. But I was over the moon when the fabulous venue Greenside.
Very good venue, Greenside.
Amazing venue, amazing people, amazing venue. And they said, you wouldn't believe your luck. Someone's just pulled out of a 2-week slot at the Edinburgh Fringe, 7:30 p.m. slot on the
it's
Royal
good
Mile.
Time. It's a good time.
Do you want it? And I was like, yeah, I will take that. So then I realized I had to write my show. So I'd applied for The Fringe, then wrote Karen, and then brought it up. And I was so pleased with the reviews from there, which then allowed me to transfer to the Other Palace. But I also just did a run up in Birmingham as well.
Very nice.
At the old joint stock, which was fabulous. That was my first, that's been my biggest audience, and a sellout of 100 people each night was madness.
And obviously the show will have evolved since last August as well, because you must be learning new things every performance.
Absolutely. And I think because the protagonist, my character, she engages with the audience directly, it means it's different every time I do it, which keeps it so fun and fresh, which I really love. But I changed it up since Edinburgh last year, more bells and whistles. Now that I tested out, you know, the skeleton of it, I'd say, you know, the story, the character, my writing, I wanted to add in lighting design, sound design, set design, really take it to that next level. And that's what we trialed in Birmingham. That was kind of our test lab. And now we're just tightening it all up for the other palace, which I'm hoping will be its greatest iteration yet.
So, and do you feel pressured in a one woman show, because that you're on your own on the stage, and that's quite scary compared to like probably used to it being theater plays with people and stuff?
100%. I think because with a one woman show, there's no one to save you. If you forgot your line, there's no friend to go, maybe it's this. There's no help for you. And if something goes wrong, and if a joke doesn't land, you're just there. It's the closest I felt I could get to stand up, because that's a whole nother ball.
That terrifies me. Every time I interview a comedian, I'm like, bloody hell, like, how do you do what you do? It's insane. Because I suppose you can hold on to the character a little bit, which protects you a bit.
That's me. Yeah. It's the closest I could get. It's me on my own telling jokes to an audience, like directly staring them in the face. But the whole back is it's a character, and if they don't like it, they don't like the character, they don't not like me.
Yeah, which must be very a little bit slightly that's actually
it's on
how
the
I
edge,
feel
though.
That's kind of how
it's on
I feel
the edge. Hosting and a pod, I have had hecklers before.
It's hard, man.
That's always good fun. Yeah. You've got to learn to just ride with that. And that was a big learning experience. So I think I'm really excited for this next iteration. I've tried out new things, but yeah, if you're really much on your own, but it means you have to really trust in the team around you. Karen's quite technically reliant. It's quite a lot of sound cues and things like that to do different things. So they need to be on it as well. But a good show that has amazing lighting design and great sound design, it just, you don't even notice that there's just one person there. So I'm excited. But I think I'm very grateful for the theatre experience that I've had. It makes me feel very confident on stage. And now that I've done it a fair few times, I feel very confident. That being said, I am very nervous for the other palace, but excited at the same time.
It's very exciting. And for anyone listening, there's links in the show notes, so click on that if you want to find out more about Karen and get tickets, etc. I know we've been speaking for nearly an hour, so I'll start to wrap things. I've got a couple of more questions, but you're speaking about with Karen, like mental health, representing, mm-hmm. like not bottling things up. Obviously, we talked about this earlier, about how uncertain this industry is and working in the creative industries, but how do you personally sort of protect your mental and physical health in such a overwhelming industry?
Such a good question, and I think it really should be taught any actor. For me, it's really been a bit of a journey. I think you're so in it when you're in drama school, you don't think about the next chapter. You think it's always going to be like this and as busy as that. And I think when you come out of that, and that it's very physical, I went to a very physical drama school, coming out and just having to fill it with my own things when I'm quite a busy person, I definitely didn't get the hang of it for a while. Like I would watch TV and I was really depressed. And, you know, I think you've really got to put plans in place. It depends what kind of a person you are. But for me, I know I needed like a nice form of exercise that I could really enjoy to like de-stress. So got into Pilates or yoga or swimming or going out and doing something sociable. If you want to go to a pineapple dance class, if that's your thing, I would say doing something social that gets you out, that's physical, is really helpful because it makes you feel like you've done something. And then I think also for me, it was I had to get a part-time job. I also just think not only obviously is it great financially and everybody needs a job to survive, but I think also just from a mental perspective, trying to do something you don't despise is very important. What can be really rough, which is why I love the name of your podcast, Get a Real Job, and just like all the horrible jobs you have to do can make it feel so much worse. Like when you're like, I, for example, sold vitamins in Heathrow, and that is rough.
That's going to be my next question is all about your worst part-time job.
Yeah, that was definitely the worst. That was the lowest of my low. I was just like, you wasn't getting paid enough. I loved the company. The company was so nice and so great. And I loved the products and I loved selling. Like, I loved sales. That was all fine. But it really just, I think when you are so desperate to live your dream, which is whatever it is, writing, acting, directing, and you're having to do a job that you don't see a future in, is it can be very heartbreaking, especially not one that you don't enjoy. And you can enjoy it because it's in a sector you like, or it, you know, if it pays well, you know, there's snakes and roundabouts there. But I definitely think something physical, seeing your friends is really important. Letting people know. I think there's a mixture between seeing your friends in the industry and then also having outside friends is really important. Oh,
definitely. It keeps you grounded as well. Because you need something. You need people to go, shut the fuck up.
100%. Or because you also need like your agony aunt friends who are going to be like, oh my God, yeah, the industry's crap. Like, blah, blah, blah. I can't get an agent either. And that makes you feel a little bit reassured. But then sometimes you can also be like, they're killing it. Why am I killing it? Then you really compare yourself. And that's really dreadful. You need someone to be like, I think the other thing is having, which is rough, but I think the creative profession is one of the few professions where you have to do other things to do what you want, which is like, I have to do this job that I don't like to succeed in this, even though it takes up my time, my effort, I can't just sit and be a creative because it's not paying me very well right now. And it's a sort of sacrifice, and it's how much can you cram in the time. So doing a job you don't hate to pass the time, or a hobby you like, find hobbies, have your outside friends, have your industry friends, do something physical, yoga, rock climbing. Another passion is so helpful. I was very lucky that mine's writing. So it feels like it's driving me forward. If the acting's not going anywhere, I can rely on my writing. And that's another iron in the fire I can push.
And I think often being the multifaceted thing is quite helpful, because again, it's be pragmatic as well, because you're not relying on one creative outlet. So I think it can be really helpful, and they all feed into each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Having multiple creative outlets if you can, and also just knowing so much of this takes time, and just keep cultivating as many like stories as you can, and reading and like inspiring stories, I think is always really helpful. No actor gets it from any one way all the time. You know, it's like the classic one, like Harrison Ford getting it by being a carpenter on set. Like, you never know when it's going to happen. And you've got to have faith. It's rough, but you got to have it. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. That was a really detailed and honest answer. Greatly appreciated. I think what's hard, I think it's really useful for people listening, because as you've been very honest, like, this is a very costly industry to, like, you know, have to sacrifice a lot, to often not have loads of money coming in the bank, and, you know, go through rough times. And I just think it's good for people to get like a sort of realistic take that's not all glamorous and stuff. Before I ask my last question, do you have anything coming up? Like, obviously, I know you've been in some other shows. Like, for example, you're in a show called The Nancy Boys, which I know a little bit about because it filmed in Scotland. That's due to come out at some point. We still don't know, really.
Fingers crossed, 2024. It's a lot of, I think it's a fantasy series on Amazon Prime, and Nancy Boys filmed, actually, I don't know if I can say.
There's some of it's online. Like, it says you're in it
some
online.
Some of it's online. So in the sense that the star is the wonderful Malachi Kirby, who is absolutely amazing, and getting to work with him was fantastic. And I think there's a lot of CGI and stuff, so it might come out hopefully this year, fingers crossed. That's something I've been in. My TV show Jack and Jill, I'm just pitching and hopefully trying to get put into development, so fingers crossed with that one. Karen is kind of the star of the show in my life at the moment.
Great. No, it's really exciting, and obviously wish you all the best, and look forward to, you know, catching it at the Fringe in August and out when you're up in Scotland.
Yeah, love that. Let me know.
No, of course.
Complimentary ticket.
No, thank you. No, very kind, very kind. Sarah, you'd been kind of very honest and full of advice throughout the show, but our last question, just your sort of closing advice for anyone listening that sort of wants to get into doing what you do, like, what would it be?
That is such a good question. I think if you want to get into this industry, you've got to have faith in yourself. And I'm not saying it has to be unfaltering. I've definitely faltered at times, in which case you need to surround yourself with people that value and support your dream as much as you do. I'm very lucky. I've got parents that support me. I've got a partner that supports me in my dream, and I'm friends, and I feel very blessed for that, because it can be rough when you get your like seventh rejection of the week and it really feels like nothing is manageable. But the biggest piece of advice I would give is have faith. It doesn't always stay bad. And you'll be so surprised what comes around the corner. The amount of times you've heard actors being like, I was going to throw in the towel and then I got my big break. That even happened to me this year. I came back from the Fringe. I was so excited. And then I got all the stuff that I thought was going to happen, these big projects I was getting put up for, and I got rejected from those. I really thought, God, can I keep throwing myself into this? And I just went, I went home. I had to rally myself a bit. And when I came back, I just started sending emails. I was like, no, she's going to pick herself up. And we're going to give this another go. And if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have got the other palace. I wouldn't be going to the Fringe again this year. I think having faith in yourself, but you've also got to put in the work. Don't just be like, I'm going to get the tube and Martin Scorsese is going to pick me. Like, you've got to put yourself in the path of opportunity as well. So that's my two-pronged bit of advice. Have faith in yourself and put yourself in the path of opportunity.
No, a very nice answer. And just to quickly expand on it, because and I know people, especially, I don't know, obviously know the ins and outs of acting because that's not my sort of day job, but like I know in the creative industry, often it does feel like you don't have a lot of control in it. There's a lot of external factors at play, but I think people sometimes forget, and what I've learned from this podcast is I think you actually have a lot more influence and control than you think you do. As we talked about earlier, you can send those emails, you can keep chasing opportunity. It might not, it doesn't guarantee you like a full-time living, obviously. That's partly is external as well, but
yeah,
I think that's an important thing for people to try and remember, that you can control things, you can change things.
You definitely can. It's very easy to fall into the, I'm never going to get picked. I can't influence anything. I'm just waiting around for someone to pick me. I get that. But I think one of my favorite examples is like the growth of TikTok, for example. I've seen a bunch of young actors, or not even just a bunch of actors or people aspiring actors, start making little clips and posting them on there, and they've gone viral. And then, boom, they're in The Crown.
Like, yeah, who's the guy in One Day again? I've forgotten his name.
Yeah, the guy in One Day.
He plays Ian in One Day. I feel so bad that I've forgotten his name. And he's great. He's so funny on Instagram.
And there's that wonderful guy. He's in 10% on Amazon as well, playing an agent. Like, you never know that thing, and obviously we'd all love to maybe have a viral video that then gets us in one of those fabulous shows. I'm not saying you have to now go and be a TikTok influencer, but you can influence your path. Get out there, meet people. One of my favorite stories is, you know, Amber Kamod in One Day. She just, one of her Vogue articles was how she was working her finance job in Condé Nast, was going on a Hinge date, got a tube early and bumped into a friend who was writing a sketch, and they said, I want you in my sketch, and it was for the MASH report. Boom, she gets signed. Boom, she's shooting.
And she's just absolutely, and she's like, incredible actor as well.
She's
smashed it
unreal.
In both
she's
shows, didn't she?
Unreal.
Incredible.
My claim to fame at this point is that we were at Durham together, and she was a couple of years above me, and she was just awesome. So I think just, you never know when your time's going to be, so keep putting yourself out there and something will come back. Something will. It might not be what you first imagined, but it will be something. And I think keep an open mind as well. Like, I didn't think writing would be my thing, but I would love to be like, go into more script writing. Or it's amazing. Love directing, love producing. You'll find other niches that you love. I think so. Keep open and keep meeting people. Keep putting yourself out there. Keep inviting yourself. Keep inviting other people to your work and doing your best. That's all you can do. And I wish there was a kind of like a perfect chemistry answer. Like, if you pass this exam, you're going to make it. Like, if you were a doctor, but this isn't that industry, I'm afraid. And it might take you on a completely different path. Like, so many casting directors were actors. So many agents were actors. Your path might be something completely different, and it will be just as creatively fulfilling. And I hope it's wonderful.
Yeah, Sarah, I think that's a great place to end things. But thank you so much for your time today. It's been a really inspiring conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I've had such a lovely time.
Oh, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much for your honesty. Cheers. Well, there you go. That was episode 129 of Just Get a Real Job. Thank you again to Sarah for her time. Really, really enjoyed this conversation. It's rare I record an episode and put it out the next day, so it's very much fresh in my mind. And it was a really nice way to start the week by chatting to Sarah. So hope you guys all enjoyed this episode. Some really interesting insights and takeaways as well. As always, if you have enjoyed this week's episode or are enjoying the podcast in general, be sure to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen. As always as well, if you enjoy it, let us know on social media, get in touch, share the podcast, tell people to listen. We're an independent podcast, and it's, in all honesty, the algorithms on things like Instagram and Twitter or X or whatever the hell it's called these days, it's just becoming increasingly difficult to get any traction. And it can be quite frustrating at times, because obviously I want as many people to hear these conversations as possible, and it's hard to reach new audiences sometimes, so any help on that front is greatly appreciated. We also have a Patreon, there's a link to that in the show notes. If you can afford to chip in anything to that, that all goes back into this podcast. We don't make a profit doing this, I'm not ashamed to say, but you know, all the money we make goes back into making this podcast as good as it can be. Anyway, that's all we have time for this week. We'll be back again next Wednesday for another episode of Just Get a Real Job. Thank you as always to Amy Dinsdale, who does the artwork for this podcast, and to the brilliant Elliot Mitchell, who edits and puts a lot of his time into making this podcast sound good. Anyway, have a lovely week, everyone. Just get a real job.